We're going to be really reflecting upon what happens in our own minds, what happens in the landscape of our own minds and hearts, and how we understand that, and how we can perhaps begin to step out of some of the compulsions and patterns that, you know, lead to the creation and recreation of distress. So this is really about us. It's not about the person who's sitting beside you, or, you know, the difficult person at home. This is really about who we are and what goes on for us. Okay, so I think that's where I want to do my introduction. So I'd really like to invite us to take some time for a short period of sitting together. So again, just finding a posture that is supportive, where there's a marriage of uprightness and easefulness. A posture where there's an embodied intentionality to be awake, to be present, to listen inwardly, and to tune into this space that we're all in together, aware of everyone around you, as we sit together with a collective intention to be wakeful, to be mindful, to care, and bringing the intention to establish mindfulness in the body, to remember the body, sitting. Mindful of the sensation of your feet contacting the ground. Your backside contacting the chair or the cushion. Sensitive to the sensation of your hands touching each other or touching your legs. And mindful of your whole body. Sitting, sensing, listening, breathing, quite intentionally just beginning to gather and collect your attention, establishing mindfulness in the body, the body breathing, and allowing the thoughts, the images, just to sit in the background of your attention, arising and passing. Not holding onto any of them. And sensitive to the whole body breathing. Expanding and the falling, relaxing of your body with each in-breath, each out-breath. So tuning yourself to that rhythm, that process of the body breathing. Sensitive to all the moments when your attention is drawn to something more predominant, a sound, a thought, a sensation in your body. Not regarding those moments as distractions, but cultivating a simple knowing of a thought as a thought. A sound as a sound, a sensation as a sensation. And renewing the intention to come back to this body of the moment, however it is, and to know the body breathing. appreciating the quietude, the stillness, the opportunity to stop and to listen as wholeheartedly as we're able to. To the body of this moment, the heart of this moment, the body breathing just now. So before we begin to explore this material, I invite you to take just 5 minutes or so to stand up and stretch if you need to use the washroom. Okay, so let's begin. Now I find that many people speak to me about their practice, and not so many people speak to me about their path. But if we look carefully at the Buddha's teachings on liberation, it's very evident that, you know, what happens on a cushion and what happens on a walking path is just really one part of this journey. And the Buddha really speaks about a path of waking up and a path of understanding that includes every area of our lives. And of course, the Buddha was passionate about understanding the architecture of distress, of dukkha, really acknowledging that dukkha, distress, struggle is not a life sentence, but is something that is created and recreated moment to moment. And he said that if we're really going to understand the architecture of dukkha in the service of bringing distress to an end, then we really do need to understand the architecture of our own world of experience, how our world of experience is being shaped moment to moment. Why do we think the ways that we do? Why do we react the ways that we do? Why do we hold the views or the opinions that we hold? Where does our view of self arise from? He said, this is what is to be understood. And he speaks about the development of that understanding and the development of that insight or understandings that liberate, that unbind the heart from those familiar patterns and compulsions of reactivity. And he spoke about the steps of developing insight. He certainly never said, just sit and all will become clear to you. What he said first is listen to the teaching. Listen to the teaching. See if you have an intellectual, a cognitive agreement with that teaching. You know, how does it land for you? How does it make sense for you in your own experience? Then he said, begin to investigate those teachings within your own experience. Begin to explore. And then, of course, the last of the instructions was embody those understandings. Live in the light of those understandings. I know for me in the last 10, 15 years, I've been, you know, increasingly drawn to really, really explore in much more depth as much as I can, together with colleagues and friends, the Pali Canon. The Pali Canon is really the body of writing that, as much as we're able to identify, really holds kind of the wisdom of the Buddha's teaching. And, you know, there's always debates about, you know, did he actually say that? Did he actually teach that? But, of course, there's a lot of research that goes into it. But I found myself really drawn to trying to understand what the Buddha was communicating. What really was his message of waking up? And it's dense. You know, it's dense. I mean, this person was quite a genius in so many ways of really just sitting down and looking at his own experience and looking at his own mind and listening to other people speak about their own minds and their own experience. It was a genius in kind of understanding that, yes, we all have a personal story, but there's also a very universal story about how distress is created and how distress can come to an end. And this was really the heart, of course, of the Buddha's teaching. He said, you know, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and that there is an end of dukkha and that dukkha is to be understood. So part of what, well, very much, much of what I would like to do this weekend is to reflect on one particular thread, one particular theme within this huge body of teaching around distortion, perception, proliferation, and the ending of distortion and proliferation. So I'd like, for me, this is kind of like a work in progress. You know, I'm really intrigued by this theme. It's something of a work in progress. So I think it's useful for us to start with some definitions. What is perception? You know, it's one of our mental factors inseparably bound up with consciousness. We perceive through the five familiar sense doors. We perceive sights, sounds, smells, touch, sensations, tastes, and we perceive what is happening in our minds, which in Buddhist psychology is the sixth sense door. We perceive what is happening in our minds, the thoughts, the images, the moods, the mental states. So what is the function of perception? It's to recognize sensory impression. It's our way of making sense of the world. And this is helpful. You know, it's helpful to be able to make sense of the world. We know which car is ours. You know, we know the difference between a bird and a cow. You know, we can identify pain. You know, we eat the food rather than trying to eat the plate. You know, we recognize the distinctions of fresh baked bread or coffee. Perception then is a messenger. Perception is conveying information to consciousness. Now, it's not only our way of making sense of the world. It's our way, so perception is kind of organized in the world. I hope you get that sense. But perception is not only making sense of the world, perception is also our way of making meaning. What something means to me. So perception is playing really a pivotal role in creating a sense of familiarity, which of course in many people's minds, familiarity equates with safety. It's a way of kind of a pivotal role in creating a sense of comfort, of knowing. When I have ascertained what something means to me, then I know how to respond to it. You know, when I've ascertained what something means to me, then it guides my relationship to what is perceived. So it's starting to bring in, perception is starting to associate. And it's starting to open that world to of our likes and our dislikes, our preferences, our anxieties, our anticipations. I know what kind of car I like. I know who I feel comfortable with and who I feel uncomfortable with. I know I go into the supermarket and I know what to buy, what I want to buy. I go into a restaurant and I know what I want to order from the menu. I also know what to avoid, what I don't like. Perception then is beginning to link in perception without mindfulness is beginning to link into a world of emotional association and memory. And of course, that world is never finished, you know, because we are exposed to new sights, new sounds, new people, you know. So perception is continuing that journey, not only to know something, but to make meaning of it and to guide how we speak, how we react, our choices, you know, where we place our attention, what to avoid. Now, when perception is repeated, it becomes memory. We don't have to keep learning our name or the name of another person. That's useful. Makes life simpler. We don't have to keep learning how to drive a car or where our food is. We don't have to keep learning what a refrigerator is. When we begin to attend carefully to perception, we quickly discover that in the making of meaning out of what is perceived, we are attributing to that sensory impression innate qualities. Is that clear to you? When perception is repeated, becomes a memory with its associations of what we like and dislike, emotional associations, drawing upon memory and past experience, innate qualities start to be invested into a sensory impression. That's really beautiful. That's really ugly. That's really attractive. That's really pleasing. No, that's kind of hideous, that's really unwelcome, So we're starting to build up a very personal world. Something is worthy, something is unworthy. So you can see how navigational perception quickly becomes mired in memory and emotional association and a building block for my world. From my world of experience. When we attribute an innate quality to an object or a person, that tree is absolutely fantastic, that person is really has the power to make me really unhappy, or that food is absolutely disgusting. When we attribute an innate quality to something to make me happy or unhappy, we are essentially making a self in that object. Something that has an independent self-existence. And of course, we assume this is true for the entire world. Everybody hates liver. everybody loves this. We are assuming that it's shared by the world. Now, is this okay? You're clear with this so far? Good. So perception is our way of establishing particular relationships to sensory impression. In Buddhist psychology, this is called sign making, S-I-G-N. It's called sign making, or nimitta in Pali. We're attributing a sign to something, a name. And a name carries a lot, doesn't it? A name carries a lot. And we discover that perception is the foundation of our particular world of experience, which may in reality be very different than another person's world of experience. One person perceives a car and becomes very excited. Another sees a source of pollution. One person walks into a crowded room and perceives a world of possible connections. And another person walks into the same room and is overcome by social anxiety. Same sensory impressions, very different responses, very different worlds of experience. So perception makes our world. Perception shapes the way that we interface with that world. Perception without mindfulness is starting to build a world of value judgments. To build a world of value judgments, good, bad, beautiful, ugly, acceptable, unacceptable, worthy, unworthy. So the Buddha encouraged us really to begin to trace this in our experience, to begin to question our assumptions, to begin to question our views, really recognizing that there is no greater source of argument in this world than clinging to views that are rooted in the value judgments associated with perceptions. And he speaks so much about, you know, us learning how to step out of the arguments, how to step out of the conflicts, how to step out of the arguments that begins with understanding. And, you know, don't we just see this in our world today, you know, not only on a global level, you know, on a social level, on a political level, and certainly in our own world of experience, we know how easy it is to be caught in the argument, you know, of, you know, the conviction of my perception being the truth and yours somehow being, you know, faulty or a lie even. So he said, let's begin to trace what's going on in our world of experience. So the Buddha was really an artist, actually, in beginning to unpack experience and offering to us a number of cognitive chains that we can trace in our own experience that help us to understand how our world is being shaped moment to moment, with mindfulness beginning to slow down that shaping process so we don't feel so bound to repetition, you know? And the Buddha spoke about sometimes distress is just repetition. You know, when he spoke about samsara, which is kind of the opposite of nibbana, you know, it kind of translates as walking in circles. Yeah? And do you know that sensation of, oh, here I am going around that loop again, you know, and here I am going around that particular obsession again, you know, that revisiting to cease to walk in circles. So he said, first we need to understand what is actually going on. So one of the cognitive chains that he offered, we can actually really trace in our own experience. What we contact, the meeting of the sense door with the sensory impression, the eye with the sight, the ear with the sound, what we contact, we feel. All of those sensory impressions, the sights, the sounds, the tastes, the touch, the smells, the thoughts, the moods, all of these sensory impressions come with an imprint. This is preverbal. They come with the imprint of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Neither unpleasant or unpleasant. What we feel, where there's feeling tone, what we feel, we perceive. What we perceive, we think about. What we think about, we dwell upon. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind and the shape of our world. I found myself, you know, my eye, I'm looking outside, suddenly two people show up, you know, we're doing something, you know. That's simply the sensory impression and the seeing and the perception of two people showing up. Okay, now, is that pleasant or unpleasant? Well, that depends on how I've been here before, you know. But I'm on a retreat, you know, so I see two people showing up. Comes one, and it's, you know, how dare they? It's unpleasant. I didn't actually have to think, is that unpleasant? You know, that was pre-verbal, but so was my response. You know, my response was pre-verbal, saying, you know, how dare they do that? Don't they know this is a retreat? A retreat, did nobody tell them? You know, so what we feel, we perceive, we think about, what we think about, we dwell upon. Well, I could go to town with this. Yeah. Of course they shouldn't be here. You know, who's the manager of this place? I need to get in touch with them, you know. I need to tell them, straighten themselves out, you know, be a bit more considerate. What we perceive, we think about, we dwell upon. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind and the shape of our world. I relook at that same perception. There goes another one. Sight, eye, seeing. Perceiving, yeah. Ah, I'm perceiving differently. Oh, look at all these wonderful people, you know, volunteering to do the garden today. Isn't that kind of them? Isn't that kind of them? You know, the imprint, depending, you know, the perception, depending on memory and depending on awareness and mindfulness, is going to shape a very different world, isn't it? I'm very grateful, you know, that they come and take care of this beautiful place, you know, give their time. And do you notice that when the reaction to the unpleasant is triggering that kind of rumination and that kind of obsession, do you notice how much more thought is generated? And how much self and other is created? You know, they suddenly have the innate capacity to disturb my silence, you know, or to disturb my space. With a little bit more mindfulness, you know, I see this lovely couple out there, you know, picking up the leaves. I don't need to have a lot of thought about this. Yeah. So these are just important components to acknowledge in our experience. You know, now that perception could differ at different times depending on what conditions are present within me. You know, if I've turned up with a, you know, a whole load of grumpiness, you know, that's going to be the lens through which I see that particular sensory impression. You know, so that's also going to shape perception. So perception is not only being shaped from the external, the five normal or usual sense doors. Perception is being shaped also by what is going in the sixth sense door of the mind, particularly in terms of moods or mental states. So, you know, one morning I could see it like this, another morning I could see it quite differently. And yet, do you notice how convincing those moments are? How convincing, how the moment that it moves into dwelling upon, you know, obsessing about, we've reached a place of conviction. Yeah, this is how it is. You know, there's no question about it. Yeah. Think about how many times that can happen in a single day. You know, where our world of experience is being shaped, the conviction that comes with it, the amnesia that comes with it. You know, things have ever been different in the past. You know. So think about how that is happening moment to moment in our life. There is, of course, very simple, necessary navigational perception. It's really useful and really necessary. But when we actually look more closely, we see that perception is very rarely navigational or innocent. That perception doesn't come to the party alone. We perceive through the eyes of how we have perceived in the past. You know, that is what this emotion, not just psychological memory, but that's how this emotional memory bank is built up and carried unless it is questioned. We perceive through the eyes of how we have perceived in the past. So our perceptions are carrying emotional history and emotional association. We know this. You know, the classic example of, you know, we encounter someone we haven't seen for 10 years, you know, or maybe you come here and you encounter someone you haven't seen for 3 years, and yet you remember the last time you saw them, they weren't that cooperative, you know, they weren't, you know, they're a bit kind of disruptive, you know, or noisy or whatever, you know, we haven't seen them in 3 years, you know, we walk through the door, we see them again, what do you see? You know, oh, there's that disruptive person, you know, that, you know, really just has the power to disturb my silence and my peace, you know. And what if they probably haven't straightened themselves out, you know, they're just going to do it all over again. You listen, it's fixed. It's so fixed. You know, if you've noticed, like, you know, we have families, you know, like I go and see my mother. I haven't seen my mother for a few months, you know. But right away, my mother's quite positive. She knows me. You know, like I can't possibly have changed. You know, she knows me. And, you know, all of you who go home for family vacations or holidays, you know, and you get slotted right into, don't you? Who you were when you were 6 years old, you know, you're still doing it, you know. It can be so fixed and so static. So our perceptions carry this emotional history and association, and our perceptions are frequently fixed, static, and unquestioned. Does make life easier, doesn't it? If we don't have to see things anew, if we don't have to question, if we don't have to allow things to change or people to change, it does seem to make life easier. You know, we don't have to investigate. We don't have to expend all that effort to understand. The sense of I know you or I know this. How do you feel when somebody says to you, I know you? Feels like a life sentence, isn't it? It's kind of like, I know you. But we see that the only thing that keeps anything fixed in place is our fixed views. In the sense of, I know you. I know this. Perceptions that are carrying emotional history and association are the direct way of bringing the past into the present and repeating the past. This is how the past is brought into the present and repeated. When I see that person I haven't seen in 3 years, I'm not just repeating my memory of them, I'm repeating my reaction to them. You know, my aversion, my ill will, my impatience. So I am repeating not just the memory, but the emotional reactivity of the past is being brought into the present and relived. Deja vu is not imaginary. We have been here before. We know we have been here before. We find ourselves repeating emotional and psychological patterns of reactivity rooted in the past. And we encounter the challenge, and this is really the challenge, of seeing anything at all anew. Seeing anything at all freshly, including ourselves. This is not just something that we externalize. This kind of way of fixing things in place is also direct imagery. You know, I'm just this kind of person. You know, I've always been like this, you know, and all of the reactivity that's associated with that. William Blake once wrote, he said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. When the doors of perception are bound up with emotional memory, association, and history, rather than infinite, the world often appears as very finite, fixed, static, and known in a particular way. Zoom. So perceptions are carrying the baggage of association and emotional memory and history, and then perceptions become sources of agitation. One of the primary functions of mindfulness is to sever the link between perception and emotional history and memory. It doesn't mean that that memory or history doesn't arise, but it's severing the link so that emotional memory and history is no longer governing, is no longer pushing us into those familiar repetitive cycles of reactivity. Because that, as long as that link between perception and emotional memory and history is in place, this is what leads us to create and recreate patterns of distress. So mindfulness is not concerned with disabling navigational perception, but the severing of that link between perception and emotional history. And this allows is what allows us to see all things anew. This is what allows us to begin to enter into that world of the infinite rather than being tied in the world of the finite. The severing of that link is what allows everything to change, including ourselves. It is what underpins the ending of reactivity. The severing of this link is what allows us to change, to be the creative, flourishing, creative beings, insightful beings that we have the capacity to be. The Buddha refers to this as being the signless deliverance of the heart. The signless deliverance of the heart. So that we are not moving through the world in our sign making, our naming, our knowing, always being bound to those patterns of distress. We could almost describe this as a process of unknowing. It's a process of unknowing. Liberating the world and ourselves from the fixed and unquestioned perceptions. And later on, as we go on, we'll visit the territory of what it is that really distorts perception in this way. So I'm still in the definition term, by the way. Still in the definition zone, in case you'd forgotten, that was where we began. So we're still in the definition zone. So let's reflect a little, because I want to make this link between distortion, perception, proliferation. So let's reflect on this term proliferation that we, before we begin to explore the relationship between distorted perception, proliferation and distress. So the word in Pali, the language that the early teachings were written and recorded in, the word in Pali is a word that many of you, I think, will be familiar with, prapancha. Does this ring any bells? Mm-hmm. Or is it a new word for some of you? If it's a new word, it's a great word to learn. You know, if you learn a few Pali words in your lifetime, papancha should be one of them. P-A-P-A-N-C-A. Its literal meaning is to spread out. Its literal translation is to spread out or to proliferate. So this is my definition of papancha. The generation of thoughts, stories, and narratives rooted in underlying patterns of confusion that distort our capacity to see things as they actually are. Okay? Got that? It's the generation of thoughts, stories, and narratives rooted in underlying, often unconscious, patterns of confusion that distort our capacity to see things as they actually are. In Pali, nibbana, or liberation, is sometimes translated as nipapancha, the ending of proliferation. And the Buddha put it, he said, this path, this teaching, is for one who delights in non-proliferation. For one who delights in non-proliferation. Isn't that wonderful? To delight in non-proliferation. To delight in stillness of mind. To delight in seeing things as they actually are. So it's actually, you know, really this invitation to imagine or to envisage a mind that is not tied endlessly to these patterns of stories and narratives and obsessions and ruminations, and to imagine the delight of that mind. You know, when the Buddha speaks about the mind, he says, you know, who is my enemy? He says, my mind is my enemy. He says, who is my friend? He says, my mind is my friend. And he says, I can think of no one thing that creates or brings about greater harm and distress than an untrained mind. And that once understood, I can think of no one thing that is a greater friend than a well-trained mind. So I think it's useful to think part of our pathway is the pathway of learning about nipapancha, of not proliferating. not obsessing, not building stories and narratives, you know, moment to moment that capture us. And the sad thing, of course, is, although sometimes we feel very beset by those ruminations and stories and narratives, the sad thing is that sometimes we delight in them. Yeah. Kind of like my fantasies. Yeah. Kind of like, you know, I'm sort of a bit infatuated with some of my narratives or my stories. You know, it's a kind of world of familiarity. It's a world of, yeah, comfort in a way. So in a way, what the Buddha is asking us is to change the focus of our delight. That's maybe the first step. Yeah. Changing the focus of our delight to begin to taste the mind that's not so bound in storytelling or building narratives or, you know, creating views, to actually delight in the mind that is no longer inclined to do this. Sounds easy. Huh? Not so easy. Now, there are different threads. In a papancha, something really important to understand. There are different threads, emotional tones, almost themes to the papancha that is generated. There is craving-based papancha. So there's always some sort of engine behind our story building, you know? There's always some sort of fuel behind our narratives and our proliferation. And sometimes it's quite useful to drop down below the story and to really ask ourselves, what is the driver here? You know, what is keeping this going? Knowing that none of our stories that might be delightful and might be nightmarish, none of them have an independent self-existence. There's always a driver. Okay. So sometimes when we find ourselves really caught in a big agitation, you know, or you know, a big lost in a story, if it's possible, it's quite useful to drop down and ask, well, what is the driver here? You know, rather than just being dismissive or saying, oh, no, that's a story, you know, I just need to let go of. We actually need to understand it. We need to understand what is driving it, okay? So the first of the themes is, that the Buddha speaks is about craving-based papancha or tanha papancha. Our fantasies, the stories we generate about that which we have perceived as being beautiful or lovely or pleasing, how the tanha-based papancha, which is implicated in how we try to arrange our world so that we have maximum amount of the pleasant and minimal amount of the unpleasant. So this, you know, a lot of that planning based papancha, strategizing, you know, about, you know, how I'm going to fix things so that, you know, I have greater exposure to the pleasant and less exposure to the unpleasant. The thoughts that are generated, or the stories that are generated and triggered by pleasant memories, or the anticipation of pleasant events, the narratives that we generate about what we need. That's a big one. You know, or what we need to become, the kind of person we need to become in order to be, you know, eternally happy. The stories that absorb us about, you know, the perfect meal, the perfect vacation, the perfect relationship. It's a big one, isn't it? It's a fairly big one. And just to acknowledge, you know, there's a lot of encouragement from our world to do this. You know, to reach away from what is into a better moment, you know, to be leaning forward into a better moment. You know, I know when I was teaching online in the beginning of the first lockdown, when I heard so many people talking about their lives being on hold, you know, and when this was over, you know, how life was going to begin again and how, you know, how much happiness there would be, et cetera, et cetera. And I found myself teaching others and teaching myself that this is not a waiting room. You know, this is not a waiting room. You know, and every time we're prone to kind of be in that waiting room mode, we're kind of almost inclining our minds intentionally towards craving-based prapancha. You know, what we will do, how we will live, what the world will look like when this is over. You know, and how often that can happen in our lives, that craving-based prapancha, particularly in moments of the unpleasant. Yeah? How that seems to trigger often that craving-based prapancha about the better moment, the better connection, the better something, you know, that rests upon this ending. And then we can live in waiting rooms for a long time. Yeah? You know, we can spend a lot of time in waiting rooms. And I sometimes hear people say, well, you know, what's wrong with this? You know, it has a kind of pleasant sensation to be lost in those fantasies, you know, or, you know, that anticipation, or, you know, it feels quite harmless. It's not harmless. It's actually not harmless. The difficulty is, the problem is that prapancha doesn't have a conscience. You know, we should not fool ourselves or try to fool ourselves into thinking, oh yeah, I can have all the tanha-based prapancha I want and have a choice about not having the unpleasant prapancha. You know, if the mind is inclined towards prapancha, it will feed off anything. It will feed off the pleasant and it will feed off the unpleasant. And we can't decide only to have pleasant-based prapancha. So prapancha is a pattern that gets equally lost in the nightmare narratives of aversion and ill will. And this is what the Buddha refers to as dosa prapancha. All of the stories that we have about what we dislike, you know, what we find hard to bear. Some people tell me that they think more about the people and situations they struggle with than the people that they love and enjoy. Or we can obsess, can't we, about our enemies. You know, how they've harmed me, how they've abused me, how they should be, you know, how I can keep away from them, you know, and how it's all their fault, you know, and they certainly have the power to make me so deeply unhappy. And, you know, the endless, you know, a small injury becomes a great harm through prapancha. Often an unintended injury becomes a great harm through dosa prapancha. We can have so many stories, and we've certainly had a lot of fuel for this in the last few years. We can have so many stories about the imperfect, the flawed, what is broken inwardly and outwardly. And, you know, it's pretty widely recognized in psychological terms that, you know, human beings carry with them almost a sort of very embedded negative attentional bias. You know, so that, you know, we walk into a room and how our attention often seems to be so quickly drawn to highlighting what's wrong rather than what's well. You know, how we sit down with ourselves and how our attention is so easily drawn to what hurts rather than the palm of my hand that's actually thriving. You know, and this negative attentional bias so feeds into this dosa prapancha. You know, I used to teach at a university in England, you know, it was a master's course in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And, you know, our teaching room, there was a coffee stain on the carpet. Admittedly, it wasn't particularly pleasant, you know. And yet the amount of obsession that went on about that coffee stain, you know, I would say 99% of this carpet is perfectly good, you know. We got 1% where there's a coffee stain, you know, and yet the attention is almost just drawn to that, isn't it? And what kind of world that shapes. You know, in that same university, all of the offices of the psychology department were on the same corridor, you know, and there was a kitchen on each end of the corridor. And, you know, one of those kitchens was, you know, you walked into it, you know, and there were post-it notes everywhere, you know, I brought cookies today, help yourself, you know, plenty of milk in the fridge, enjoy, you know, don't worry about the dishes, you know, we'll all pitch in at the end of the day, you know, have a lovely day. And then on the other end of the corridor was another kitchen, And again, covered with post-it notes, you know, don't touch my milk, you know, the biscuits are not yours, you know, wash your own cup, you know, don't leave anything behind you. And I used to think of them as being the happy kitchen and the unhappy kitchen. And I thought, well, what is shaping those different kitchens on the same corridor? I have to say with some humility that the happy kitchen was on the MBCT end of the corridor. But I thought, well, what is shaping those worlds? You know? And how much there's this kind of dose of papancha going on in the unhappy kitchen about all these, you know, inconsiderate people who are just making my life miserable. You know, and I thought, well, what kitchen do I want to live in? You know, I'd much rather live in the happy kitchen. Where I don't have to, you know, deal with that sense of the broken. We have many stories about the, you know, the failed relationships, you know, the vacations that didn't meet our expectation, about everything that we dislike in the world and in others and in ourselves, stories we've told, I have to say, 1,000 times already. Stories that we've told 1,000 times. That we go around in circles, the stories about our irritations, our disappointments, our failures, our annoyances. This is all in the realm of dosa papancha. And it is burdensome, isn't it? It's burdensome. The mind that is lost in dosa papancha is not a happy mind, does not feel to be a mind that is a friend. I'm actually wondering, still in definitions, by the way, I'm actually wondering, because we've been in here now for an hour and a half, whether this is might be a good time to take a change of posture so that we can come back and listen and not feel uncomfortable. So I'm going to suggest at this time we take half an hour for some walking practice. And again, just a sense of settling into the body, into this moment, inhabiting the body, inhabiting this moment with as much mindfulness, wakefulness as is possible for us. Sense of returning and also appreciating these moments of quietude, these moments of collectedness, these moments together. And listening inwardly. Listening to the life of the body of this moment, however it may be. Listening to the life of the mind, heart of this moment, however it may be. And in the midst of all of this, establishing the intention to collect and to gather our attention. To establish wakefulness, mindfulness, sensitivity within this body, within this body breathing. So there's a very familiar rhythm to how the Buddha would often teach, where he would begin often by examining the nature of the wound, the nature of the struggle, the nature of the distress, in order to make a diagnosis. In order to make a diagnosis, he very much used the medical model. In order to make a diagnosis, and that once a diagnosis had been made, he could offer a prognosis, you know, the possibility of healing. And once a prognosis had been made, he very much linked that prognosis to a course of action, a course of response. So I'm kind of familiar, following that rhythm during this weekend, where we're starting to name and to unpack a little bit the nature of the distress, the nature of the wound. But it does end with good news. It does end with good news. So far this morning, we've been really looking at what perception is in terms of Buddhist psychology, beginning to unpack or examine this tendency or this pattern of proliferation or papancha, which I will continue with. But I'd actually really like to pause just now. And so I'd like to invite us all to begin this afternoon session with a sitting period. Again, just beginning with establishing a posture of embodied intentionality, wakeful, upright as you're able to be, in your back, in your neck. And grounded, feeling the weight of your body, touching the ground, the cushion, the chair. Gathering, collecting your attention, and establishing mindfulness, wakefulness in this moment just now. And the thoughts and the images just to arise and pass, to sit quietly in the background of your attention. And foregrounding the body of this moment, this changing landscape of sensation, the body as a process. The body breathing. Thank you. Just want to check in the Zoom room that you can hear me all right. Thumbs great. Thank you very much. So just to recap a little bit about where we left off. So this morning we did some reflecting upon perception, the nature of perception. We started to talk about papancha, about craving-based papancha and dosa or ill will-based papancha. This third layer of papancha is in the Pali, it's baya papancha. And this is fear or anxiety-based proliferation. Its main feature is worry. Main feature is worry. We can worry a lot, and we can worry about a lot of things. If you consider how many stories we can have that are rooted in our fears of instability and insecurity, how strong is our craving for safety? Understandably human, and yet somehow at times in denial of the way things actually are. We can be anxious about our health. We can be anxious about our world's crumbling, about losing things, losing the things we love and cherish. We can worry about getting what we don't want. And we can worry a lot about being out of control. And I think the pandemic has been especially designed to trigger baya papancha. We can worry about illness, about dying, about making mistakes, about being disapproved of, about being blamed. We can worry about being visible, and we can worry about being invisible. A Christian mystic once said that anxiety is the mood of ignorance. Then anxiety is the mood of confusion. And as I mentioned, you know, not everyone does baya papancha, but I'm imagining you can possibly relate to some of this. You know, when we're not, when our worlds really are turned upside down, when we really don't know what's coming next, when we really do feel lost, how we feel ourselves just reaching out to try and find some stability, some ground. And it is so very, very human, you know, and we see, you know, in childhood development, you know, just how important safety is, you know, how important predictability is, you know, how important certainty is for children to thrive. And so there's it's a big ask then, you know, to recognize that in childhood development, and perhaps goes on longer than that, but to recognize the futility of worry, to begin to recognize the absolute ineffectiveness of worry. I mean, that's quite a big eye-opening insight, you know, if we really are so convinced that this really is not going to make a difference, you know, why would we do it? Because we keep hoping it will make a difference. You know, I have a Dharma friend, a colleague, you know, who worries about flying. I mean, fortunately, she's been relieved of that for a few years, but she used to worry all the time about flying, you know. And she said, I know it's irrational, you know, I know it's not logical. She says, but I do it anyway, because there's a little voice in me that says, my worry is keeping this plane afloat. And if somebody didn't worry, this plane would drop. Yeah? So there's that little part of us that is imagining that somehow this is really making some kind of difference, you know? So worrying. The fourth of these threads of papancha proliferation is called ditti papancha. It's about views. We don't know we have views until we bump into an opposing view. Then we really realize how strong our views actually are. Yeah. We have views, the views that we hold about life, about people. You know, turn on your television, particularly during election times, and you're going to be exposed to a world of views. You know? Turn on the media, you listen to the storm of views, political views, religious views, social views. We have views about our views. You know, then my view's right. You know, and I keep looking for the evidence to support it. We have stories about those who support our views and those who disagree with our views. Views that see conspiracies everywhere. Views about rebirth. You know, Buddhism's rife with, you know, all Dharma circles, all, you know, spiritual pathways can become rife with views, you know. Views about rebirth, views about race, views about class. There is probably, excuse me, no greater cause of argument, no greater cause of dispute, conflict, and suffering than holding so tightly to opinions and views and beliefs. You see this in the time of the Buddha, you know, when the Buddha used to go in his life, you know, kind of wandering from village to village. And if you read the early texts, they're basically a record of arguments. You know, he turfs up in a village, you know, and everybody who's got a different view comes out to argue with him, you know, to disprove him and to prove the correctness of their view. It's really a record of arguments. And it's perhaps no surprise that the Buddha speaks so much about the liberation of stepping out of the argument, of not holding on to views so tightly. We can see how much our views divide the world into friends and enemies. You know, those who agree with us, those who disagree with us, the kind of, you know, selectiveness that goes on about who we hang out with, you know, who we're willing to speak to. They undermine, views undermine, you know, the clinging to views undermines the very wholesome qualities of tolerance, of generosity, of kindness and compassion. And we really do see how much the holding on to views reinforces the sense of the self and the sense of the other. And as I mentioned, we're not often so aware of how tightly we hold to our views until we meet someone who sees the world differently than we do. It's a difficult one because, you know, we do. You know, we have ethics, you know, we have views about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, you know, what is skillful and unskillful. You know, this is part of what sets us on a path, you know, a sense of direction. So it's perhaps not so realistic or even desirable to say that, you know, we shouldn't have any views. What would that be like? So maybe what the Buddha is really pointing out here is how tightly we cling to those views. How much selfing is invested in those views. The Buddha put it, he says, I can see no other single factor so responsible for the suffering of living beings as distorted views. No other single factor so responsible for the arising of the unwholesome states as distorted views. Our views determine our actions, they determine our choices, what we give time and attention to. Our views, in a way, determine our value system, what we dismiss and what we pursue. Our views guide us through what we want to avoid and how to navigate our way through our lives. But you will notice in the quote from the Buddha, he speaks about distorted views. He doesn't actually speak just about views, but about distorted views. Now, the last of these threads of papancha is in Pali, mana papancha, M-A-N-A. This is the story of me. It's the story of me. The I am story. The narratives that we have about who we are, about what is possible and what's impossible. The story of our judgments, our guilts, our shame. The story of our ambitions and aspirations. The story of our bodies and the story of our minds and hearts. I sometimes do feel that this particular thread of Papancha is probably the most toxic. And I also feel it's probably the root of all of the other threads of Papancha. That all of the other threads of Papancha proliferation actually have their roots in the me story, the story of who I am. It's a long story, isn't it? It's a really long story. Sometimes it's a story we've inherited. Sometimes it's a story that's been thrust upon us through our education, you know, through our families, you know, through our friendship groups. It's not that we've all just, you know, independently constructed the story of me. There have been so many threads throughout our lives that have contributed to that construction of the narrative of who I am. And it's often so charged. It's often so charged. This mana papancha, it's almost like there is actually two dimensions to it. One dimension is what in Pali is called Sukhaya Ditti. It's this personality view. It's personality view. Yeah? I'm an extrovert, I'm an introvert, you know, I'm capable, I'm incapable, you know, I'm worthy, I'm unworthy, you know, I'm smart or, you know, I'm not so smart, you know. This is Sukhaya Ditti, it's personality view. Now, you notice with personality view that it can change a lot. It can change a lot through life experience. It can change through different exposure to different conditions. And it can also change depending on what is being identified with or clung to in the moment. Yeah? I'm happy. No, I'm really sad. You know, I'm anxious. No, I'm really hopeful. You know? Have you noticed in a single day how many selves have you worn today? You know, did you get up this morning with a particular personality view, you know, particular self view? You know, great day, you know, I'm all up for this, you know, I'm really capable, you know, you go to breakfast, something goes wrong, you know, you don't have your right muesli, and oh, life never works out well for me, you know, and I never get what I want, and I'm always a failure, you know, you arrive here, the sun's shining, you know, maybe I'm doing okay after all, you know, you come across a Pali word that you have no idea what she's talking about, you know, and everybody else is smarter than me, you know, knows what she's talking. Oh, it's exhausting. And it can change a million times in a different day, depending upon what is identified within the moment, in the world of our thoughts or in our somatic experience or our encounters with the world. It's such a shifting landscape, you know. It's hard to find anything at all that is enduring in that landscape because the locus of our clinging keeps shifting from one thing to another. At times, the story of me feels very generational and very inherited. But it's fluid. It's fluid. You know, Paul Brock's a neuropsychiatrist. He, in his book, The Silent Land, he's a neuropsychiatrist who spent his whole professional life trying to find the self, which he admits failure, couldn't find it. He said the story has been told so many times that we're no longer telling the story. The story is telling us who we are. The story is telling us who we are. We can wake up in the morning and feel that we just step into the story of me. governing our actions, our choices, our aspirations, or our sense of impossibility, it is a story of contractedness. And it's a story of clinging and distress. It's an agitation. We can become so convinced about the reality of this story, even describing ourselves as a type. You know, I'm an aversive type, you know, or I'm a craving type, you know. This is really unfortunate. So one aspect of the story of me, this manapapancha, is Sakkaya Ditti. So the Buddha has two ways about talking about the self-construction. So one is Sakkaya Ditti, this personality view that can be very fluid, depending on what's identified with, can change 100 times in a single day. Now, the second way that the Buddha speaks about the self-building is in terms of mana. Now, literally, this is often translated about as the conceit of self, which is a very awkward translation. But it's much more about relational selfing. Much more about relational selfing. How I see myself in relationship to you. And the Buddha says, well, there's three forms. I got a lot of threes and fours and fives. And this. So there's three forms of mana. One is that I basically see myself as being superior to you. I'm better than you. You know, I'm better at things. I'm more capable. You know, I'm more lovable. I basically see myself as being better than you, superior to you. It's a big story. I mean, the second of these threads of mana is called inferiority conceit, where I see myself as really being much worse than you. Inferior to you. I'm much less capable. I'm much less able. You know, I'm much more of a failure. I'll never be like you. You know, I'm always going to be the one who's kind of assigned to the sidelines, you know, the kind of loser, you know, just doesn't do things very well. Not as beautiful, not as smart, you know. Anyway, all of that. And the third of these forms is called equality conceit, where I look at the world around me and I basically see that we all share in this kind of sea of mediocrity, you know, that we're all failures, you know, that human beings are essentially useless, you know, that human beings are essentially unintelligent, you know, untogether, you know, no one can aspire to anything. No one can ever be free. Everybody, you know, these things, everybody is greedy, you know, everybody is aversive, you know, those kind of generalizations. This is equality conceit. Now, it might sound like it's not so serious. It's really serious. It's really serious because this can govern our whole lives, and I don't see much fluidity in it. You know, and I think, again, this is often a story that is told to us by others. It's often one we inherited as a child. If you were told, you know, you're always failing, you know, or you're always making mistakes, or, you know, you're never good enough. Well, guess what? You know, that gets absorbed into the bones. It gets absorbed into the bones, you know. If you're a child and you're told, you know, look how smart you are. You're smarter than everybody else. You know, you're better than everybody else. You know, this gets absorbed into the bones. I don't see much fluidity in it. Now, this obviously, this personality view and this sense of relational selfing are very tied in together, you know, because if I am possessed of inferiority view, guess what I'm going to cling to? Guess what I'm going to contract around? Every bit of evidence of inferiority, you know, everything that proves that view. You know, if I'm, you know, invested in superiority view, guess what's going to be clung to? Every piece of evidence of my success and my brilliance and my togetherness, you know, that's going to, you know, prove and legitimize that view. And, you know, if I'm locked into equality conceit, you know, I'm just going to see failure everywhere. You know, no sense of aspiration, no sense of possibility. So these two are really interacting and interfacing. And you can imagine you don't have to imagine, you can realize the amount of narrative that is generated out of this, you know, out of our personality views, out of our relational selfing, and you know, when the Buddha says, you know, when there's no clinging to a view of self, there's no clinging to views at all. And I think that's really quite profound teaching. You know, how do you know there's clinging? How do you know there's clinging? You know, we don't go through our days clinging all the time. You know, we don't go through our days grasping and identifying in every moment. You know, there are moments of clinging, moments of grasping, many moments of the day when there's no clinging at all. You know, you go out for a walk and you're not particularly the walker, you know, comparing yourself to everybody else who's walking, you know, and thinking about how terribly or how brilliant. You're just walking. You know, you brush your teeth without this kind of background voice assessing, you know, how well you're doing it. You know, there are a million, there's many moments of non-clinging in a day, but there's also moments of clinging and you feel it. You know, you feel the contractedness. You know, you feel it in the body, you know, the closing down, the tightening. You feel it in the mind, the shrinking, the contracting of the mind. And as the Buddha put it, this is really the kind of pivotal point, you know, the cessation of clinging, the cessation of clinging, the cessation of grasping. It's like if you have an open hand with a sharp stone in it, it really doesn't hurt. But if you close your fist around that sharp stone, it really hurts. So we're learning time and time again in those moments of clinging, the possibility of releasing the grasping, releasing the clinging, and that is releasing the clinging to views. Part of so much of this path, you know, the Buddha says that investigation is the most important factor of awakening. You know, so much of this path is really to begin to investigate, you know, what are the drivers behind our narratives? You know, what are the drivers behind our prapancha, behind our selfing? And to really question, are those drivers life sentences? You know, are they really life sentences? And just because something has a long history certainly does not imply that it's a life sentence. We question, you know, does prapancha, for example, really contribute to well-being and freedom? Or is it limiting and contracting, causing distress? We can feel to be such a prisoner of our narratives, going round in endless cycles of repetition. And each time, of course, we go around those cycles, solidifying the sense of I am. But what we accept is that when perception, and this is why I'm trying to start to tie all of this together, when perception is distorted, prapancha will be generated. When perception is not aligned with the way things actually are, the stories are fueled. Prapancha also fuels distorted perception in closed feedback loops. There's a wonderful discourse when it's called the removal of distracting thoughts, where the Buddha describes, I think, the early years of his practice when he's actually really looking at his own mind. And he said, suppose I divided my thoughts into two categories, more or less. He said, in one basket, I put the thoughts that are unhelpful, unskillful, that lead to distress, that lead away from freedom, that lead to confusion. And in the other basket, I place all the thoughts that are helpful, that lead towards understanding, that lead towards freedom, that lead away from affliction. He said, when I do this, then I know what to cultivate and what not to cultivate. I know what to feed and what not, and what to fast. And I think this is such an interesting exercise for any of us to do in a single day. You know, that thought, does it lead to affliction? Does it lead to the end of affliction? You know, is it skillful? Is it unskillful? You know, does it lead towards freedom? Does it lead towards more binding and more confusion? Then we know what to cultivate and what to fast. It's an interesting exercise to do in any moment of our day, in any sitting period, in any walking period, just to explore that territory. Because this is the place of discernment, you know, and mindfulness is much more than just watching things. It's being able to ask those questions, because discernment is really the link between mindfulness and skillful response. You know, without discernment, actually, we are just, mindfulness becomes very passive, becomes just watching, where we can be almost a spectator upon our own disasters. So that's why I want to take a pause moment after Papancha, before I start to reflect upon some of these distortions. So I want to take a pause moment, see if there's any questions, any reflect or ugly. So we'll distort how we see. The last of these core distortions is to see that which is not self as being self. To see that which is not self as being self. This will distort how we see, and then follows on how we react, how we experience, how we perceive. So these are the core distortions that twist perception in ways that we don't see things as they actually are. Now, these core distortions, they're called vipalasas, by the way. These core distortions are essentially the landscape of what in Buddhist teaching is called avidya or ignorance. If you unpack this word ignorance, which I'm sure any of you in practice have come across occasionally, if you come and unpack this word avidya or ignorance, what you discover are these four core distortions or vipalasas. Sometimes they're rather, you know, probably not adequately referred to as wrong view. But this is what generates papancha, the stories we tell. This is what generates unwise thinking, intention, and speech. Essentially, these four core distortions are what gets us into trouble. So this is the roots of dukkha. I mean, sometimes, you know, when you read something like the Four Ennobling Truths, you know, it says, you know, craving is the root of dukkha. But when you look beneath craving, what you see is avidya. You know, the landscape is actually much deeper. You see ignorance, you see the core distortions. Is that clear? I just want to pause. The last of these core distortions is to see that which is not self as being self. To see that which is not self as being self. This will distort how we see, and then follows on how we react, how we experience, how we perceive. So these are the core distortions that twist perception in ways that we don't see things as they actually are. Now, these core distortions, they're called vipalasas, by the way. These core distortions are essentially the landscape of what in Buddhist teaching is called avidya or ignorance. If you unpack this word ignorance, which I'm sure any of you in practice have come across occasionally, if you come and unpack this word avidya or ignorance, what you discover are these four core distortions or vipalasas. Sometimes they're rather, you know, probably not adequately referred to as wrong view. But this is what generates papancha, the stories we tell. This is what generates unwise thinking, intention, and speech. Essentially, these four core distortions are what gets us into trouble. So this is the roots of dukkha. I mean, sometimes, you know, when you read something like the Four Ennobling Truths, you know, it says, you know, craving is the root of dukkha. But when you look beneath craving, what you see is avidya. you know, the landscape is actually much deeper. You see ignorance, you see the core distortions. Is that clear? I just want to pause for a moment, just make sure that that landed in some recognizable way. Yes, please. Oh, microphone. And so seeing ignorance as being satisfactory rather than unsatisfactory. Okay. It's 2 o'clock. Okay, we'll go for 15 minutes and then we'll take a walking. Is that all right? Well, then we'll take a walking period?
Just before.
Well, no, I've got, yeah, but I just want to start just a little 10 minutes on this and then we'll. Okay, let's take the first of these core distortions. Seeing the impermanent as being permanent. Hmm? Now, does anybody here disagree with impermanence? Anybody got an objection? Think it's not real? Think it's not true? You know? No? That's interesting, isn't it? Is that how we live? Yeah. Is that really how we live? Isn't that something? This gap between our intellectual, conceptual knowing and how we live our lives. I mean, despite all the evidence, despite our life experience, you know, despite everything we've ever learned or understood about impermanence, we still seek permanence. Isn't that something? Or we fear permanence. We're not just always seeking permanence. Sometimes we're fearing or anxious about something being permanent. We fear our mortality and the changes our bodies go through. We can make heroic efforts to prolong and to keep the pleasant. We despair at the unpleasant continuing. You know, this is going to last forever. You know, it's never going to end. This difficult person or this difficult situation, you know, has now moved into my life and they're permanent. We perceive many things that are as being satisfactory, as having the innate capacity to provide us with lasting happiness. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you kind of look at the world and say, make me happy? Yeah? Make me happy. We externalize the sources of happiness and satisfaction, and we see them as being innate in certain events, experiences, people, and objects. We see fantasy and lust and power and prestige and the ongoing pursuit of the pleasant sensation somehow is being satisfactory. When in reality, it brings distress and agitation to our lives. We equally see the unpleasant objects and sensations and experiences as being somehow having that innate capacity to make us unhappy. We see the untrained mind as being satisfactory. Yeah. See the untrained mind as being satisfactory. When in reality, we know it's just not so. We perceive things as being intrinsically beautiful or ugly. By the way, just to clear up, in case any of you have got this in your Dharma histories, you've sometimes heard body contemplation is describing the loathsomeness of the body. Has anybody ever heard that? Please, it's not accurate. The Buddha never talked about the loathsomeness of the body. He said asubha, not intrinsically beautiful. We perceive things as being intrinsically beautiful or ugly, again, investing them with the power to govern our choices, what we avoid or pursue, how we furnish our world, essentially. We find ourselves again and again falling down the rabbit hole of selfing. You know, the I am, my body, my emotions, my thoughts, my views. I used to be, I will become me at the center of the universe, you know, the pilot in the cockpit. And we don't always see how the self of the moment is shaped by what we cling to. And the shape of the self can and does change countless times in a single day. We forget the sad self at lunch. We forget the happy self at breakfast. We become enchanted with the self of the moment. This is me. This is mine. This belongs to me. This is who I am. It can become the underlying mantra of our lives. So I want to pause there before we have a walking meditation, because I'd like you to think about how some examples of how you might see the unbeautiful to be beautiful, how you might see the unsatisfactory to be satisfactory, how you might see the impermanent as being permanent, or dread something as being permanent. How you might notice the formation of self. I'm asking you to do some work here. I'm asking you to do some work here, because otherwise it doesn't mean anything if I'm just, you know, talking head up here. So I'd like you really, really to think in your lives, you know, how you, some examples of these core distortions. Remember them? Seeing the permanent, seeing the impermanent as permanent, the unsatisfactory to be satisfactory, the unbeautiful to be beautiful, to be seeing self where there's non-self or no independent self-existence. So try and really just think perhaps of some examples that you can spot in this. So without mindfulness and understanding, perception is looking backwards to the four core distortions. Perception is drawing nourishment and substantiality, looking backwards to the four core distortions, to interpret present moment experience. And perception then is looking, within the absence of mindfulness and understanding, is looking forward to papancha or proliferation. Okay, so distorted perception is drawing these two things, this arena together. The core distortions being feeding distorted perception, which in turn is generating the papancha. Can you see that continuum, I hope? See how this operates in the mind. If we see something as being intrinsically beautiful or able to provide lasting happiness, it follows that papancha and behavior will be generated to pursue, to get, to achieve, to hold. So papancha is not just kind of, you know, some kind of storm inwardly. It's actually shaping our actions and our choices and the ways that we interact with the world. So papancha is actually moving body and mind into action. Distortion, creating papancha, moving body, mind into action. If something is perceived as being intrinsically ugly or threatening to our happiness, papancha then will be used to strategize how to fix, how to avoid, how to get rid of, and our choices and our actions are going to follow in the wake of that papancha. So in a way, the distortions, the distorted perceptions and the papancha is not just shaping our mind, it's actually shaping how we are engaging with the world around us. If we see ourselves as being solid, the body and mind as being who I am, then behaviors are generated to protect and to defend and to assert or to fix or to improve this I am. So you can see the shaping of our world and our choices and our actions and our speech. We sometimes worry about what we perceive as being permanent. We tell stories about what we want and need to be happy. We go around in circles of thought that are really riven with ill will. We pursue the perceived beautiful and avoid the perceived ugly. We build stories of self again and again. Papancha, I think, this whole, you know, weight of papancha, I think it cannot really cool and stop unless the distortions are deeply understood. We could ask ourselves, you know, how many stories have I found myself lost in today? How many conversations have we rehearsed? What have we found ourselves avoiding or pursuing? And do we really want this to be the story of our lives? Do we really want this to be the story of our lives? Or would we not more wish that the story of our lives is written by the wholesome and the skillful and the compassionate and the insightful? I think, you know, it's a real question of do we understand that the Buddha is teaching that when distortion comes to an end, papancha comes to an end, and distress comes to an end. Suppose you have a difficult neighbor, one who's noisy, uncooperative. See how that would unfold, you know? This person makes me so unhappy. Rehearsing the conversations, we're going to have them rooted in ill will. Going round in circles, feeling the agitation. Do we want that to be the story of our lives? In the Honeyball Sutta, you know, this is one of the most renowned suttas about understanding about how we get ourselves into trouble. The Buddha traces really how the worlds of distress are built. He says, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of papancha beset a person, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, to aversion, to views, to doubt, and to the self story. The end of the underlying tendencies for becoming, the end of ignorance. And he says this is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, the end of disputes, the end of recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. These are the unwholesome states that cease without remainder. I personally think this is such a profound teaching of possibility, because the Buddha's not talking about, you know, negotiating with these patterns or just calming them down, you know, or, you know, yeah, negotiating with samsara, you know, ceasing without remainder, you know, that these patterns of distortion that lead to distress, that lead to estrangement, they can be uprooted without remainder. That means they're not coming back, you know. It means they're not coming back. I think this is a sort of truly aspirational sense of this path. You know, what the Buddha describes as a sort of possibilities of a human being for freedom and to see the end of these patterns. And, you know, just bearing in mind that the Buddha, you know, didn't seek for perpetual students. You know, the Buddha really sought for graduates. You know, people really who came to the same understandings in the same ways that he'd come to, you know, and found this sense of profound liberation. So how, you know, the question now that follows, I think quite naturally, is the how. You know, how do we bring distorted perception to an end? How do we bring prapancha to an end? I think the genius of the Buddha lies in seeing that just as perception can lead to distortion and distress, perception that is stripped of its underlying distortions can lead to the end of distress and freedom. So the Buddha then starts to talk about using perception as a tool of healing and liberation, rather than as something that leads to distress. Okay. Are you feeling a bit tired? Are you feeling a bit low energy? Some nods. Some nods. This is a lot of information to absorb. I'm very aware of that. So what I'm going to suggest is, because are you free next week? What I'm going to suggest actually is that we take a 10-minute stretch now, or a 10-minute stretch, and then we come back for a short sit to end the day. And tomorrow we'll start again. Yeah? And by the way, if you don't come tomorrow, you've really missed the solution. You're stuck in distortion, prapancha, forever. Knowing the story of this mind, this heart. Appreciating those that we sit with, sitting with the story of their own minds, hearts. And in the midst of this, we're beginning to cultivate the sense of ground, sense of kindness, the wakefulness. Breathing in with mindfulness, breathing out with mindfulness, breathing in with sensitivity, breathing out with sensitivity. Sense of caring for the body, of caring for the mind. Of integrating body, mind, and present moment. So I really want to thank you for your listening today, your attention, and also your questions and reflections, really much appreciated. And tomorrow we will be continuing. Believe it or not, there's still more to say. So we'll be continuing. So hopefully you can return, and see you at 9 in the morning.